It's the only time you have control of Bob McCowan. Let's go. Subscribe to Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand.
Just as a point of reference, I don't write those little promo things that start the beginning of the show. I have nothing to do with them.
They're accurate, though.
I can't disagree. I'm not inclined to disagree, and I can't. Greetings, salutations to y'all. It's primetime, hour number 3 of 3 for this Tuesday, the 26th of the month. I'm Bob McCowan. This is Michael Zeisberger right here of the Toronto Sun. Sid Rosenberg of WABC Radio in New York will join us. A little bit later, also Arash Madani, to talk about tennis and the Rogers Cup, which is on in both Toronto and Montreal. The men are here, of course, and the women are in Montreal. But first, one of our favorite guests, Dr. Harry Edwards, is a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of California, and he joins us on the telephone. Dr. Edwards, good of you to join us again. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good. You and I are of an age where we can recall the 1960s, the importance of that decade for African Americans, the significance of a personality, a sporting personality like Muhammad Ali and his outspokenness, the Cleveland meeting that he was at, Jim Brown was at, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, then Lew Alcindor was at, et cetera, et cetera. And the notion that black athletes had a platform that they were able to use to create social awareness of issues that related to them. Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player I think any of us have ever seen. And yet I was I often commented that I wonder what Michael thinks of this as situations happen during the course of his illustrious career. And almost, I don't remember a time when I found out what Michael thought. And now, here as Michael Jordan is well into his retirement as a player and his position in ownership in the NBA, Michael Jordan has spoken out with regard to the relationship between police officers and communities in America, which is at an all-time high in terms of tension. As somebody who has been around through all of that, as I have, were you surprised that Michael Jordan took this opportunity to speak?
No. I think, first of all, we have to understand that all of these movements, including the 1960s and today, are framed by developments going on in the broader society, whether it's the Civil Rights and Black Power movement, whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement. There's a broader framing of these kinds of eras, and it is within that context that athletes speak out and that their voices and their concerns make social, cultural, and political sense. If you look at the 1980s, the mid 1980s and into the 1990s, not only was there a claim that we had begun to move toward a non-racial society, post-racial society, but the claim was that the civil rights movement was not only no longer in existence, but that it was dead and not needed. So there was not the framing there during Michael's active years that other athletes had enjoyed, both in the 1960s and today. As we moved forward, even in those instances where Michael did things that I'm aware of in terms of aiding the community and so forth, he did not want the publicity attendant to that because it would, one, lead to a legion of other requests that he would have to sort through and determine what was legitimate and what was not. It would most certainly potentially impact his business interest. And it would put him in a situation where he set a precedent where every issue that comes up in the African-American community, he would be expected to speak out on it at a time when there was no framing to give legitimacy to those kinds of statements. He'd have been out there by himself, essentially. So today, you have the framing, you have the movement, you have the anti-police violence thing going on with the Black Lives Matter people, you have the president speaking out on it, and more than that, going all the way back to the Los Suns T-shirts, jerseys worn by the Phoenix Suns,
right,
in protest of the immigration policies of the state of Arizona, right up through the hoodies of the Heat and the Don Sterling situation, and most certainly the Trayvon Martin, the Mike Brown situation, and so forth. There's a context within which he could step up and step out, and I think that he did that because all of that support structure, ideological, political, was there. And not only did he step up and step out and become public, but he put $1 million to two groups that were largely adversarial, each to whom he wanted to see come together on this problem.
Is it fair then to say that as an African-American who has obviously intimately followed the development of the social struggles of the black man in America, that when Michael didn't speak as a player, you were not, I don't know what the right word is, upset and angered sounds too strong, but you were not concerned by it? You understood why he chose to keep his thoughts generally private?
Well, I understand why he did things and stayed away from the publicity. I also understood that it was inevitable that a generation of athletes would come along whose political attitudes and dispositions would be framed by the broader set of relationships that were evolving in their era. That has always been the case. Jackie Robinson and that whole situation with him and Larry Doby and Kenny Washington in football and Woody Strode, Marion Motley, and so forth, Chuck Cooper and Earl Lloyd in basketball, they weren't out there operating in a vacuum. This was the post-World War II America, and there was a tremendous push by after World War II, which was essentially a race war, to broaden the basis of democratic participation in American society, since blacks had died and killed in Europe, in the South Pacific, and everywhere else, to
right.
broaden the basis of democratic participation in Europe and in Japan and so forth. So these things don't occur in a vacuum. So I was not disturbed or upset. The only issue was, would Michael Jordan still be around when the next era inevitably came about, and it's here now, and he's still around, and he's contributing.
Just in the context of this conversation, the way it's gone so far in the first few minutes, give me your take on the influence of people like Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, who were very vocal about their position on race relations in the 1960s. Jim Brown, to this very day, is you know, whether you agree or disagree with many of his positions, he still has strong opinions and he's willing to share them. Do you think it was important, Harry?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because of the forum and the megaphone that they have, athletes, particularly black athletes, where you have so many categories of occupation and so forth that blacks still do not have access to in representative numbers, and there tends to be a ceiling on them when they enter many of those professions and so forth, despite the fact that we have an African-American president in the White House, that forum that athletes have is unparalleled. I spoke to a group of junior high school athletes, young black athletes, and I asked them straight up, if you had a choice of being President Barack Obama or Steph Curry or LeBron James, which one would you prefer to be?
Mm.
President Obama got 3 votes. 3 hands went up.
Wow.
For President Obama. Wow. So the megaphone that these athletes have is
powerful.
Is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yes. And Ali used it probably better than anyone in history, down to and including his struggle over his name, the right to be called Muhammad Ali. He proved that that was not only acceptable, that name, but that it could be embraced, and he paved the road for millions, tens of millions of Americans to go to the poll and vote for somebody with a funny-sounding name like Barack Hussein Obama and put him in the White House not once but twice. You can trace that back to
Muhammad Ali.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
Dr. Edwards, Bob and I have been talking about this the past week, but when the Rooney Rule was put into the National Football League, in which you know, minority black candidates would have to be interviewed. for head coaching positions. Right now, you know, we look at it. I believe there's five. I think, Bob, we went over five black head coaches. There's
six.
You know, there's a dearth of them at the general manager's position. Is this still an issue, even though the Rooney Rule is in place?
Absolutely. But we have to understand that people do not change their behavior out of morality or even out of adherence to the law. They change their behavior out of interest. You don't have 75% of the players in the National Football League thereabouts being African Americans because the owners of the NFL like black people. They are in there and they understand that if you want to win, if you're playing blacks, you'd better be playing blacks if you want a chance to win. And so it was out of interest that the locker rooms were desegregated. It was out of interest. And when those interests change, you see a different perspective on African-Americans, even in the locker room. So today, in given the globalization of baseball and the establishment of these academies in places like Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic and so forth, you have a smaller proportion of African-Americans in Major League Baseball today than you did the year that Jackie Robinson retired, because it is no longer in their interest to go into the inner city and recruit. So when we look at the Rooney Rule, that was an effort to try to compel equity and morality. The only way that African Americans have ever advanced in American society is when it was in the interest of the mainstream to move progressively and move away from the status quo. And then there was still this effort, this reaction of retrenchment that we had to, where we had to be steadily vigilant. So I'm not surprised that even with the Rooney Rule, we're in the circumstances that we are in the National Football League, or for that matter, in Division I football in this country.
When the Rooney Rule was announced, I mean, I think you and I were both, all of us were respectful of the agenda. It was an attempt to create some level of justice. And I think what we have now seen is that the mistake that was made is in not recognizing the source of the hirings for head coaches in the NFL, who all come from one pool, generally small pool, of defensive or offensive coordinators, as a general rule. And so if the pool of African Americans in that pond is small, the chances of those guys getting head coaching jobs is equally small or even smaller. Would you then recommend that the next step be to expand the Rooney Rule to include all coordinators?
We could expand the Rooney Rule to include Division I institutions.
Well, yeah, I mean, you want to go to college football, you're 100% right there.
Yeah, and still, we would have this challenge, because what it comes down to is that when that owner and that franchise president walks into that room and sits down with that head coach, he has to make a decision. Is this the guy that I want managing the $865 million that I put on the field every Sunday in the NFL? And all too often, that person, if that individual is black, falls outside of that owner's comfort zone. So despite all of the efforts to legislate justice and legislate conscience, we find that we're in the same situation in sports as we're in society. Despite Brown versus Board of Education, Topeka, Kansas, in 1954, that desegregated schools, today in American society, schools are more segregated than ever. There is a greater proportion of Africa. There are greater numbers of African American students attending predominantly black or all black educational institutions than there were in 1954. So these are issues that we have to deal with, because nobody really wants to deal with the fundamental problem in American society, which is white supremacy. We have this myth that slavery was America's original sin. Well, slavery didn't materialize out of the morning mist. It materialized out of an ideological bent that drove people who came here from Europe to see to approach the shores of this nation, see people standing on the shore, but then declare that they discovered America. So we have to understand that we're going to have to deal with the fundamental basic problems. And once we deal with that, we won't have these charades and patinas of justice and effort and so forth, such as the Rooney Rule. The Rooney Rule hasn't worked. It will never work because it doesn't address the problem. It tries to address the symptoms of the problem.
Last point before we let you go. Give us your take on the WNBA's position and how they handled their players in support of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, I applaud Maya Moore and Tina Charles and all of those women who stepped up and said all of the killing must stop, that we're spiraling down to a national nervous breakdown that's in nobody's interest. For the WNBA to then turn around and fine them, and then to rescind the fine and come out with a statement that we support these women, to me reflects upon a dearth of leadership and probably discussion and dialogue within not just the WNBA, but in the NBA, which is the basic source of funding, structure, and so forth for the WNBA. That's the way David Stern set it up. So what that tells me is that despite the Donald Sterling thing, despite the ads that have been run about gun violence, despite CP3 and Dwayne Wade and Carmelo and LeBron going on stage doing the ESPYs and saying, we have got to end this madness. We've got to bring an end to these killings. There was not that discussion at the highest levels of the NBA and the WNBA, and so they can you have this ridiculous suspension and then rescinding the suspension with a statement followed by a statement of support, which is absolutely meaningless. So I applaud the women who stood up. I hope that they continue to stand up, and I hope that those discussions begin to take place at the highest level in the NBA as well as in the NFL, which is also going to see some similar types of actions beyond those that have already been staged in the National Football League.
Well said, Harry. We thank you, as always, for your time. It is worthwhile, and we enjoy it very much. We hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Dr. Harry Edwards, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California, and one of the smartest guys I know.
Fascinating. And you can feel the emotion coming out of him when he's talking about these subjects. And it's been that way, Bob, for decades.
And Harry has been on this program intermittently for 20, 30 years. I am always astounded by his brilliance and his ability to, his use of the English language is extraordinary. And his passion for the cause is exemplary. He's a great guy. Tennis is on. After Wimbledon comes, well, the Rogers Cup in Montreal for the women, in Toronto for the men. Arona Rashmadani is at the tennis center at York University for the men's tournament. Are you going back and forth at all, Arash?
No, I'm here. I'm here for the men and frying and roasting down on the court, Bob.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, I know you care.
Yeah, well,
you're all broken up about that, eh, Bob?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm in a nice air-conditioned studio. Yeah. How do you like that?
I thought Madani doesn't cover stuff like in Toronto. He's always, you know, overseas.
Oh, no, this is a rare thing. Exotic. He gets to actually sleep in his own bed, assuming he has one.
You know, I saw him blow by me for Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final. I don't even think he had covered any other Stanley Cup games. But you know what? Hey, the cup might be presented. Arash Madani is there.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show you. You know what? He is the closer. You are the closer, my friend.
Well, he's got the pipeline to somebody. I don't know who it is, Madani.
No, go on, please.
Dennis Shapovalov. How'd I do with that?
Not bad.
All right. Man, oh, man, the kid wins. He's down a set at Wimbledon in the junior final and storms back. And then, as kind of a, oh, yeah, watch this, puts a whooping on Nick Kyrgios, the a top 20 player in the world, a guy a lot of people think could be, should be, will be a top five guy at some point, like could be a star. He's a bit nutty, but we've had nutty players in tennis before. At the top of the food chain. See McEnroe, see Connors, etc. See Vitas Gerulaitis, etc. I mean, you've got to be impressed by this kid, aren't you?
Yeah, and impressed, Bob, with his moxie, too. You know, they asked him, where do you want to play? I mean, they gave him a main draw wild card, so he didn't have to qualify or do anything like that.
Right.
And when they said, hey, you want a side court, he just kind of looked at the organizers and he said, nah. I want center court under the lights.
Yeah, man.
He wants the stage. And that's what's kind of cool about this kid is that, you know, he wasn't rattled at Wimbledon when he had a chance to win it. He wasn't rattled last night when Kyrgios was having another meltdown. He wasn't rattled when, you know, a sold-out place in his own backyard under the lights in his first ATP 1000. There's something to him. And he grew up in a tennis family, and last night he was just overjoyed by it all. And tomorrow night he'll be under the lights again. He's the nightcap of the doubleheader after Milos Raonic.
So in your assessment and watching the match, and I only saw parts of it, so I didn't get the full picture. You know, Kyrgios was pissed. Kyrgios wanted to quit at various stages. Was this Kyrgios being the nut bar that we've come to understand he is anyway? Or did this kid make him feel that way?
No, the kid didn't make him feel that way. I think there are two stories here. One, Shapovalov was terrific. Let's not discount or discredit anything that he did. You know, the kid did his job, and Kyrgios had his antics. There's no question about that. At one point, I actually left the court, and when I came back after a changeover, Kyrgios and I, the day before, spent like 15 minutes. I saw him in the players' lounge. We were just talking about basketball. He's a huge Boston Celtics fan. I asked him what he thought about Tom Brady trying to recruit Durant. So he recognized me right away. And during a changeover, he didn't even bother, Bob, going to sit down. He just stood there on the corner.
Yeah.
And when I got onto the court, he just kind of looked at me. He's like, hey, what's up, bro? And I said, I'm good, Nick. How you doing, man? And, like, this is with everybody watching.
Wow.
Everybody listening. He said, well, I just don't want to be here. I want to go home. And I was, you know, obviously taken aback.
Wow.
What are you talking about here? And he said, yeah, I don't want to be here. Then he gets to another changeover where he actually sat down.
At the end of the court, right?
Yeah. No, well, this is a separate one.
Okay.
He's actually sitting in midcourt, and he looked over at his box over his right shoulder. He said, I'm going home. I don't know about you, but I'm going straight home.
Wow.
So here's a guy who said he wanted to play Pokemon Go more than play the match, and he was off doing his thing. Now, that all said, the kid was great. The Canadian kid really played well and showed why there's some real promise for the next generation of Canadian tennis.
Aside from Arash, Nick pulling the chute here, the fact that the kid played so well, I mean, obviously there's been buzz around this tournament on the heels of what Milos did over at Wimbledon, but can you feel the extra vibe or the extra buzz around this, kind of the momentum building just because of how well this kid has done?
Yeah, it's part of its eyes. There's no question. I mean, there were three Canadians who won yesterday, which helped. And, you know, in the lead up to the event, it was kind of like, okay, well, all the big guns aren't coming. Well, Roger Federer just shut it down for the year, right?
Yeah, so we were going to ask you about that, not to interrupt, but, I mean, is it for the year, or do we see this extending even further than that? Could this be it?
Yeah, well, what he said was that he's shutting it down because doctors have advised him, if he wants to play pain-free and injury-free for years to come, that it's best to just get some rest and do some rehab. And Federer's statement was, my intent is to play for years to come. Now, what does that mean? We'll see. But Fed says he wants to continue to play. And, you know, without him here, there's definitely a void. But suddenly you have a 17-year-old who's going to be right after the Wimbledon finalist, and they both just happen to be Canadian. It's a real cool little story that's developing here over the last couple of days.
And it's kind of nice when you look at what happened with the kid at the amateur at the Canadian Open golf this past weekend, a lot of buzz around that. And then now in tennis, all of a sudden, you know, maybe you don't have to attract the strongest fields all the time if the homegrown, you know, talent comes to the forefront like they have in these two events.
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be a big help. Now, you still would love to have Nadal and Murray here,
oh, yeah,
of course. But there's no question this has become a big story, too.
Is that your cell phone vibrating there?
It sure is.
Who the hell's calling you? Don't they know you're on the air?
It's actually the producer in our production truck.
Well, he's an idiot. Just ignore him entirely. We'll let you off in 3 minutes.
Haven't you told him that Bob trumps everything?
Oh, I'm about to tell him once I get off this phone call.
Yeah. Just make sure you tell him that it was Zeisberger that said that.
Okay.
I will.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, I think a lot of us kind of got a little, you know, raised a Spockian eyebrow when Federer announced he wasn't coming, and then Serena announced she wasn't going to come, and Murray didn't come. And you kind of go, oh, God, and maybe, is it something here? Is it the schedule?
Well, the
this
Olympic thing, right?
I know. And the Olympic, and then you got the U.S. Open, right?
Yeah, and you have Cincinnati in between.
I know.
What's good about this event now is that you have a scenario where on semifinal Saturday you could have Novak Djokovic against Milos Raonic.
Well, I know, yeah, but you'd rather have that on final Sunday, wouldn't you? I mean, things being equal.
But that would mean if you get that scenario unfolding, and who knows what's going to happen over the next couple of days,
right,
you're guaranteed one of Djokovic or Raonic in the final.
Right.
And now, outside of Roger Federer, I actually believe, fellas, in the aftermath of Wimbledon, this week, that Raonic even moves the needle more than Djokovic, that people are coming here to watch the Canadian.
Oh, 100%. I agree with you.
Sure.
Right? More than Nadal, more than Murray, more. It wouldn't have been that way any other year until now.
Yeah, I don't know about Federer.
Federer
is beloved and no matter where he goes. So he does move the needle.
I've talked about this. Roger Federer is the only athlete on earth who has a home game in every match he plays,
100%.
In every city he plays, in every country he plays.
Absolutely agree. Yeah, absolutely agree. Beloved by everybody.
Yeah.
What do you think of his long-term future? I know we don't know enough about this, really, but we know that he's going to sit out the rest of the year, won't go to the Olympics. The first step here was missing Toronto, and you know, I think I kind of looked at him and went, well, gee, I wonder what's going on here. I didn't think he was hurt. I thought he was just tired or disappointed or something. But he's clearly got a problem, and he's going to have surgery, I guess.
Yeah, and just shutting it down for the season is what just, you know, jumps right off the page for you.
Can he come back?
Well,
at his age, can he come back and be anything like what he was?
He can. There's no question about it. I just spoke with Radek Stepanek today, and you're saying, who the hell's that? Well, here's a guy who's 36 years old who had some kind of nerve damage in his right leg last year, and he couldn't play for 6 or 7 months. He couldn't even sleep for about 2 months because of the pain, and every time he moved, it made a big difference. He's back playing. I mean, he's a top 100 guy, but he was never an elite singles player throughout the last few years.
Yeah, a top 100 guy coming back is a nice story. Roger Federer coming back and being a top 3-4 player in the world is a bigger mountain.
Here's the one thing about Federer has more money than God. So he doesn't need to play week in and week out. He can be very selective in the events he plays.
Yeah.
And ultimately, he's after another major, right? So he's going to tailor make his schedule around the Grand Slams.
Right.
He won't need to play 25 events next year.
Yeah.
He may get away with playing a dozen.
You got to go. You got 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 second, and then the producer's going to yell at me. Not that I care, as you well know. But
I very well know.
Enjoy the rest of the week.
Thanks, pal.
All right, boys. Good to hear your voice, Ice.
Arash Madani of Sportsnet. He's at the Rogers Cup here in Toronto. So women, Montreal. Men, Toronto. Next year, visa.
Back and forth, back and forth. And then we can talk about the big names that don't come.
Do you like... Are you a tennis guy? You don't pay that much attention to it.
Not that much, but...
No. See, I'm a casual tennis fan.
Yeah.
You know, U.S. Open comes along, Wimbledon comes along. Australian, I can live without. French, Italian, I can live without those. I'll watch a little bit, maybe. But there's like three events that I like to watch. This decision to go with the men and the women on the same week.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, pisses me off.
I really think they shoot themselves in the foot by doing that because they're taking some of the spotlight away from each other.
I like the fact you got 2 weeks. I got 2 weeks at tennis. I got the women for a week. I got the guys for a week. Vice versa. 1 week we're in Montreal. The next week we're in Toronto. I understand it's not ideal for Tennis Canada. I know there's a lot of jockeying back and forth that has to go on. So?
What happens if Bouchard, you know, and this is all hypothetical, but like, you know.
No, they'll never have Bouchard. I know you're going to go down. What if Bouchard's in a semifinal or a final at the same time as Brownage?
Yeah.
They won't do that. They stagger those kinds of events. They're not stupid. See, Rogers owns both of them. We televise both of them. We ain't going to put one opposite the other one. I mean, they're not the brightest candles on the menorah here, but they're not that stupid.
But what I'm saying is that because even if it's on the same day, Bob, you're still stripping them of a lot of the publicity that they would have for if they were the only game in town.
I don't think 2 weeks of tennis is too much.
Forget about being the only game in town, the only game in the country.
And you know what inevitably happens? For me, anyway, since they've been doing this the last few years, I wind up focusing on one or the other. And it's almost invariably who's left in the field.
Yeah.
As the week progresses, like I'm going to choose what match I watch on any given afternoon, morning, evening, whatever. Who's playing? If it's, you know, Claude Thamalfichuk against Orest Thamalfichuk, I'm watching that match. I mean, I'm sure they're nice players, nice guys, all that kind of stuff. I'm going to watch the most interesting match. Men's match, women's match. When I get to the final, I'm still going to do the same thing. I'm not probably going to invest 5 or 6 hours in tennis. So I'm going to choose, even when it comes to Sunday, which final is more interesting. If you got Federer against Djokovic on the men's side and two lovely ladies who I don't really am not that interested in on the women's, well, I'm going to watch the men. You know, if it's Williams against Bouchard on the women's side, well, I'm going to watch that one probably. I just don't understand the psychology of doing it all 1 week. But then again, like most things around this joint, they don't ask me. When we come back, Sid Rosenberg from 77 WABC Radio in New York. Are the Yankees sellers? Does the Chapman deal indicate that, or is this a one-off? I think we all know the answer to it, but we'll find out what a New Yorker thinks when Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Minutes before the hour. McCowan and Zeisberger in our Toronto studios. Some technical issues, but hopefully Sid Rosenberg of 77 WABC Radio in New York will join us in a second. He was on a cell in the... I don't know what it is about New York. We had problems with cell yesterday in New York.
With banks.
Yeah, that's
big
who it was.
Storms coming through.
Well, that was yesterday. I mean, 2 days of storms?
Yeah. Hey, maybe the Yankees are making that deal, Bob.
What deal?
Maybe they're cleaning house.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think they've decided. Well, we'll talk to him. We'll get his take on it. But he's trying to find a landline to call in, and hopefully he will be able to do that. We always like landlines more than cell phones. As lovely as cell phones are, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, they're good for playing that Pokemon thing, I think, but as telephones? the Aroldis Chapman move is an interesting one for the New York Yankees. But does it signal surrender? And the consensus so far seems to be no.
No, and I don't think it does either, but I think if you look at that Yankees roster, it should be.
Oh, I get that. The dilemma you have is, even in New York, or maybe more especially...
Yankees.
In New York, how do the New York Yankees surrender when they're only 5 games or 4 games back of a wild card and playing better than 500 baseball? Regardless of what you think of the team.
Yep.
And we all know they have more holes than Swiss cheese. And they got a bunch of old guys they would really like to get rid of. Can you do that? I mean, George Steinbrenner in this situation, with due respect to his kid who runs the team now, you think George Steinbrenner be selling? When did George Steinbrenner sell anything?
If George Steinbrenner was running the Yankees, Chris Sale would be a Yankee today.
He'd be the least of them. Well, they'd have a payroll that would be $400 million.
That's right.
So I don't know. I think it might be harder for the New York Yankees to concede defeat in that marketplace than any other place.
That's a given. And you said, like you said, they're only 5 games out. But even in their own division, they have 3 teams that they have to leapfrog.
I get it, and I understand it, and I agree with you. And I think the Yankees ultimately, by the end of this week, will become sellers.
But can you do that in New York?
Like, I think the thing that is probably driving them craziest in New York is every time the Yankees turn around and win a game, you go, oh, no, this is getting harder and harder. I think management is hoping they lose.
It would have been easier for them to come out of the All-Star break and hit the skids.
What are they, 3 games over 500 now? What are the Yankees? You got the standings there? I think they're 2 or 3 games over 500. I mean, if they're 3 games under 500, no sweat. I mean, there'd still be a lot of New York fans will be mad. If you did it now, they'd be suicidal in New York. Yankee fans would go berserk.
And what happens if on the same day you trade your assets away, the New York Mets and go and get Jonathan Lucroy from
the Milwaukee
Brewers.
Yeah.
Which they've been linked to.
Yeah, one thing you know about New Yorkers too is you are either a Mets fan or a Yankees fan.
There's no sitting on that outfield fence.
No. There aren't a whole lot of people that go to both games. There aren't a whole lot of people that root for both teams. Now, I'm not saying a Yankee fan would rather see the Boston Red Sox beat the New York Mets in the World Series.
No.
So there's a line.
Yes.
But it ain't now. Right now, there's no line. It's I'm a Yankee guy or I'm a Met guy.
Look, the Jets and Giants play in the same stadium, and it's the same thing there.
The only thing is, we talk about the competition between the Yankees and the Mets, and that competition exists among fans, but those fans have already made their decision as to who they're a fan of. I don't know. I was going to say the Cubs and the White Sox are pretty similar. I don't think there are a whole lot of, don't you think? I don't think it's as strong as New
York. I just don't think
there's
a large cachet of White Sox fans to begin with.
Yeah, maybe. Well, there's enough. If they're playing well, people will go.
Yes.
But do Cubs fans go? The Cub fans say, well, you know, White Sox are playing tonight. Let's go
Cub
down to the
fans have gone for over a
let's
over
go to the
century.
South side. Let's go to the South side and watch the White Sox. I don't know.
It's less scary in the North side.
But see, the thing is, if the Mets win, it makes Yankee fans and the Yankees mad. but it doesn't send more fans into, what's this ballpark called, City Park now?
Yeah.
I keep wanting to say Shea.
City Field.
I don't think more people go. Where's Sid? Is he trying to find a phone? Lost in an impenetrable forest? All right.
He's somewhere with Banks trying to find a lawn.
Is he in the, at the ballpark? He's in New York. It's too loud. New York? Too loud?
You talking to me?
That's one of those interesting generic statements. Like, you know, the obvious next question in any other city would be, well, where are you in New York? You don't have to ask that. It's New York. It's loud everywhere.
There's no quiet places in New York.
In a cab, in a bar, on the street, no matter where you are. Loud. So I'll ask you. I'll interview you instead of him. Aroldis Chapman's trade to the Chicago Cubs. It's not the white flag.
No, not at all.
But if you're a Yankee fan, how can you be happy with it?
Well, because I think you made a deal from a position of strength.
They got good stuff back, we think.
Yes. Plus, you've got two guys at the back end of that bullpen that can do that job.
Yeah, but this is Aroldis Chapman. He throws 105 miles an hour.
And he can walk at the end of the season.
Who's a Yankee fan? Just sign him again. Yankee fans say, I don't care. Just sign him again. Nobody walks away from the New York. Well, they didn't used to. Nobody used to walk away from the New York Yankees over money. Nobody. If they didn't want to keep you, they let you walk. If they wanted to keep you, they kept you. They'll pay you more. I mean, to the point of paying you ridiculous amounts.
That's an interesting dilemma because, you know, there's been that theory thrown out there that they are waiting for Bryce Harper. Can you imagine? You know, there's people talking that when Bryce Harper, if he ever hits the market, could command $500 million.
I've heard all these stories. Shulman gave me that story on air one day, the $500 million story. I've heard the New York Yankees are going to sign Bryce Harper. I don't know how anybody knows that. The New York Yankees aren't the only team that are going to have the financial wherewithal or financial stupidity to give a player $500 million. I think the Boston Red Sox would be in that race. I think the Los Angeles Dodgers would be in that race. I mean, with the economic reality of television today and what they're paying for games, it's astounding. These little cable companies paying gazillions of dollars for the rights. There's teams out there that could do that. Now, I like Bryce Harper. He's a good baseball player. But he's one guy.
He's one guy.
Can't win with one guy. That's why they have 25 on the roster. That's why there's nine guys on the field at once.
That's why you look at the Los Angeles Dodgers and they're in so many trade rumors right now. And yet, it was funny because the last two or three years, we've talked about how clogged the Dodgers outfield is, how they have to get rid of outfielders. And now one of the positions that they're looking for.
Well, they'd like to replace Yasiel Puig. They'd like to deal him and get somebody else.
Well, they'd like to wash their hands of that Carl Crawford contract, too.
Well, I think they've already given up on that one. I mean, really, is somebody going to sign him?
But when you look at the Dodgers' payroll, which I believe, Bob, and correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't know where it is now.
But it was the highest.
Last year was the highest.
It was the highest. And then you look at their
$300 million.
You look at their roster. Is that the best, most talented roster in the league? Not by far.
No, but you had Kershaw at a gazillion dollars, and that's just a start. Look, when my friend Stan Kasten went out there to become president of the team and the new ownership bought the club, the commitment was win and win now, and money doesn't matter. And the truth of the matter is the Dodgers make so much money, they generate so much revenue, they can afford to spend $300, $400 million. You don't think they'll be interested in Bryce Harper? Where do you want to play? You want to play New York, or you want to play in La La Land? I mean, I know where I want to go. I just don't know quite yet where Bryce Harper wants to go.
I didn't know Vegas had a team.
Not yet. See you tomorrow. Good night from Toronto.
Thanks.